Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This next award has nothing to do with an inconvenient truth. It's called the Poppy. It goes to that candidate for president who wins the most votes but doesn't actually get to become president.
Daryl Hammond as Al Gore on Saturday Night Live a couple of weeks ago. We'll tell you why we played that in a second, but this is Election Day 2007, and later this hour we will have an informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific Election Day exit poll on the stem cell ballot question in New Jersey. Are you voting yes or are you voting no? But for most Americans, on an off-year election day, the significance of today is that it is now exactly 1 year before the presidential election of 2008. Maybe you remember that University of Virginia political analyst Larry Sabato was here a few weeks ago looking at the Democratic and Republican races, and we invited him back specifically for this election day to talk about a few of the proposals in his new book, A More Perfect Constitution, 23 proposals to revitalize our Constitution and make America a fairer country. And yes, that's right, even one constitutional amendment seems to take national upheaval to get it passed. Sabato has had the audacity to propose 23 of them. The two we've chosen to drill down on today are his proposal to reform the Electoral College, a reform that probably would have given Al Gore the presidency in 2000, and his proposal to require universal national service. So, Professor Sabato, welcome back to WNYC, and happy Election Day.
Oh, thank you. Same to you, Brian.
Let's dive in right in here. Your Electoral College proposal has the chapter title, Mend It, Don't End It. Now, if the Electoral College can give the presidency to someone who loses the popular vote, as happened in 2000, why not just end it?
Well, I'm actually mending it so that can't happen. Here's why I want to keep the rubric of the Electoral College. It enables us to isolate recounts to a state or two. And think back to 2000. How would you have liked it if we had had a very close election nationally and had had a recount necessary in all 50 states, in all 300,000 precincts? I can guarantee you we never would have gotten a president. The Speaker of the House would have served as acting president probably for all 4 years. That's not what the American people would have wanted. So we can change the Electoral College, as I do in A More Perfect Constitution, to reflect the popular vote and also eliminate electors, people as electors, because you always have the problem of some of these people deciding to vote for Mickey Mouse or whoever they choose, which they're allowed to do under the present rules. So I change that, and I change a number of things.
But I'm not sure I understand. If you are saying that the popular vote winner would automatically get elected under your Electoral College system, why have the Electoral College? Because the only thing the Electoral College can do relative to the popular vote is determine a different outcome, right?
No. Essentially, what it does is it isolates the lawsuits that come. And we're a very litigious country.
Right.
So this would focus the lawsuits in a particular state or maybe two or three states at most. And it would enable us probably to get the system satisfied and all the lawsuits dismissed by the time of January 20th. Without the Electoral College, I think that becomes impossible anytime you have a very close election.
Is the value of the Electoral College kind of like affirmative action or proportional representation? It makes sure to give small states a voice, so a Rhode Island or a Delaware don't become completely irrelevant and therefore their needs are not addressed by the potential presidents?
Yes, essentially the Electoral College gives value and worth to the votes of even small states. Without an Electoral College, without those two senatorial bonus votes, it's very likely that candidates for president would simply flit from New York to Los Angeles with stops in Chicago and Dallas along the way.
So how would you mend it?
How would I amend the Electoral College?
Yes.
I take the population figures from the latest census, whatever it might be. In this case, it would be 2000 shortly. It will be 2010 census. Mm-hmm. And then you will allocate additional electoral votes to each state based on the percentage of the population they have of the total, of the national total, so that the larger states are going to get more electoral votes. I don't think we deprive the smaller states, any of the smaller states, of any of their current electoral votes, but you add electoral votes on top for the more populous states.
So, in other words, it's weighted like it is today, only more so to the more populous states. You're saying that the small states have too much power under the current Electoral College.
That's it, exactly. It's always a balance, and I do this with my proposal for the U.S. Senate, too. You want to get the porridge just right. You don't want it too hot. You don't want it too cold. I would argue right now we have it too cold. It's too skewed to the small, less populous states. I don't want the small states ignored either, and that would happen in a pure popular vote system, in addition to the legal problem in the case of close elections.
Listeners, should we mend the Electoral College? If so, how? And what do you think of Professor Sabatow's ideas? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to our comments page at WNYC.org. And I said we were going to take two of your 23 constitutional amendment proposals. Let's talk about the other one a little bit, then we'll take callers on each. The other one is mandatory national service. Is this another way of saying reinstitute the draft?
Partly, but it's much more than the draft. I have a completely original proposal for national service, because it says, and I really want an article in the Constitution that has a Bill of Responsibilities to match the Bill of Rights, because we do have responsibilities to our system. And the fundamental part of the Bill of Responsibilities would be universal national service, 2 years of service between the ages of 18 and 26, and you would have three choices. You could pick a branch of the military, or you could pick a non-military governmental service, such as the Peace Corps or AmeriCorps, or you could pick any qualifying nonprofit, such as Teach for America, there are literally hundreds.
Yeah, I see you've got a list published here of potential or possible groups that would satisfy the requirement: Doctors Without Borders, Meals on Wheels, Humane Society, Make-A-Wish, Save the Children, et cetera, et cetera. ASPCA.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and I'm talking about a sub-minimum wage so that it truly is service, mm-hmm. but health care provided and educational benefits scaled to the kind of service. I think military service, obviously, since it's risking life and limb, deserves the most educational benefits.
Well, how would you distribute people to the front lines in Iraq, or, you know, the Humane Society? How would you choose if you know, many more people wanted to do the more domestic service-oriented ones than go abroad and fight overseas?
Good question. Now, there's no question that fewer people will apply for military, but fewer is relative. In fact, there will be far more people in all branches of the military under this universal national service than there could be currently. I mean, we're having trouble filling the quotas.
I see, but if everybody in that age group had to do something, and even a small percentage chose the military, that would be a lot more people than we have now.
Precisely. How do they choose? Well, each individual would apply to a certain number of organizations. The organizations would get to pick. You would have a formal application process. Now, what happens to those who are not picked by their organizations? Well, in some cases, they'll be assigned anyway to those organizations, and in other cases, they will fill quotas appropriate to their skill levels in other nonprofits or governmental organizations.
We'll take some calls in just a second, but let me ask you a politics question about that proposal, because as you note in the book, presidents like to talk about national service but not really require it. The first President Bush with his 1,000 Points of Light program, strictly volunteer. President Clinton with AmeriCorps, same thing. Funny enough, I think in this post 9/11 and Iraq-Afghanistan war era, this President Bush hasn't really proposed anything. But you know, Clinton, for example, used to talk about the idea of mandatory universal national service, and when he got into office, it became AmeriCorps, very thin, you know, reflection of the original idea. What is it politically really difficult?
It's very difficult unless young people want it. And what I've suggested, and as you know, it's a full chapter. I've fleshed it out more thoroughly than I think anybody ever has on a universal national service project. And I have found, I'm a classroom teacher, I've taught 14,000 students over 29 years in college. I've found that young people, or a lot of them, are very idealistic. They want to do something like this. They would welcome this opportunity as long as they knew that all their peers were doing it too, and they weren't losing their place in line for professions that they have their eye on.
Let's take some phone calls. First, on the Electoral College, Professor Sabatow's proposal to mend it but not end it, and Richard in Babylon, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Brian. How are you today?
All right. What do you got?
I just wanted to talk to Professor Sabatow about it's kind of impossible to change the Constitution when your biggest opponents would be the haves and the have-not states. The have-nots are those with small populations. The have states are those 12 states that are battleground states that are now the focus of presidential campaign attention. With the winner-take-all proposition, which 48 states have, states such as New York, California, which are big population states, are merely spectators. Ask your audience, when they write a check to a presidential campaign, have they ever seen their check pay for a commercial, a public ad in this region? It's the battle between those states that have really skewed the political agenda towards the Iowas, where you have now policies that are, you know, bankrupting us.
Right. Richard, thank you. And so, Professor Sabatow, what do you think about this controversial idea in California to split up California's electoral votes? Of course, if California is the only state that does it, and they vote overwhelmingly the majority Democratic today, so the Democrats almost certainly in the presidential election will get the biggest pot of electoral votes. This proposal would benefit the Republicans because they would distribute electoral votes by congressional district. So if you have 30 congressional districts in California, I don't know what the actual number is, and let's say 16 of them go Democratic and 14 of them go Republican, obviously that's a much different outcome for the presidential election than having a winner-take-all system. But maybe it's closer to the kind of thing that you're envisioning.
Well, actually, I come out against that proposal in my book, A More Perfect Constitution, and I do so because while it appears to be small-d democratic, it is not, for a very important reason. Our system is totally skewed to the incumbents. The redistricting process is run by the incumbents for the incumbents, and therefore they create districts that distort the popular vote. Richard Nixon would have defeated John F. Kennedy handily under this system in 1960. In 1976, Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter would have tied had this been a national system of allocating electoral votes by congressional district. It's a terrible idea. It exists right now in Maine and Nebraska. It shouldn't even exist there. They've set a bad precedent for the rest of the country. If I can just comment on the gentleman's question.
Yeah.
One of my other 23 proposals is designed to make some sense out of the insane presidential selection process that we're about to see unfold, and I reduce the power of Iowa and New Hampshire and the other early states in a way that I think he will like if he takes a look at it.
Right. You've got four regional primaries, basically, right?
That's correct. With all states that have four electoral votes or fewer we have a lottery on January 1st, a lottery for the regions and a lottery for those states, those 20 states with four electoral votes or fewer. We have two lotteries. We pick two or three states in the small category to start off the process. See, it doesn't always have to be Iowa and New Hampshire. It's a good idea to have a couple small states starting us off, but it doesn't always have to be Iowa and New Hampshire.
You're saying rotate them on a lottery
system. Rotate them. So that every state has an opportunity to go first.
Marjorie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marjorie.
Yes, hi. I wonder what the professor thinks of the proposal to have the states enter an interstate compact agreeing to go by the national popular vote. when 270 electors' votes are up, they would agree to go by the national popular vote and send their electors to the winner of the national popular vote. This would eliminate having to go through amending the U.S. Constitution, which is practically impossible.
You talk about impossible. That system will never, ever work. And in fact, only a tiny number of states have expressed interest in it. Hardly anybody's passed it. It's not going to happen. Also, it shouldn't happen, and here's why. If that system is in effect, it only takes one populous state to back out of it right at the end and throw the election to the other candidate. And my guess is that would happen in, let's say it's California, and the Republican has won the election. And under this compact, all the states are supposed to throw their electoral votes to the Republican. Well, California is overwhelmingly Democratic. The pressure would be enormous on California to violate that pact. And under the Constitution, the electors can do as they wish. That's the problem with tackling this without doing it the right way, which is the hard way, which is constitutional amendment. And that's why I call for constitutional convention. You'll never get this out of Congress. We need a constitutional convention.
University of Virginia political analyst Larry Sabato, my guest on WNYC. His new book, A More Perfect Constitution, 23 Proposals to Revitalize Our Constitution and Make America a Fairer Country. We're digging a little deep on two of his proposals, one to reform the Electoral College and one to require mandatory national service for all young Americans. And here's a comment on our comments page on the national service question. It says, I support the idea of universal service. It would inject a sense of community and democracy into the population and step back from the idea that the only way to serve the nation is to kill for it through the armed forces. And here's another comment on that. Jay in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jay.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
All right.
Just going to follow up on what your guest said. The two-year and a half national service in the military is a great idea. There's a lot of young people out there, like myself, they're interested in it. But the problem is, after the two-year bid is up, you have to enlist in the selected reserve or like a guard duty for another 24-month obligation. After that, 4 years in active reserve. So basically, you're in there for an eight-year commitment. Now, we all know with the war going on, you're going to get called back up. So if you want to serve for a year and a half, 2 years, that's great. But like myself, I just can't put my career on hold for 8 years.
Yeah, and I salute this young man for being willing to serve and also for pointing up this practical difficulty. And here's how I would handle it. Because you will have a much larger pool of people available to the military, you will not have to have these constant recall-ups of people who've already done their duty. I think it's one of the most outrageous facets of the current situation, where the handful of people who have volunteered in a patriotic fashion to serve in the military are being asked to sacrifice again and again and again and again. We have to share the sacrifice. We have to spread it out. And this Universal National Service program, and I hope you'll take a look at the details, will enable us to do it.
Any downside to this program that you're afraid
of?
Sure.
If you're a libertarian, you think it's a terrible idea, and I understand that, because libertarians do not believe in government compulsion, and this is compulsory service, no question about it. So I understand the philosophical objection. We'll have to agree to disagree.
Any downside to your electoral college reform idea?
I think it's fairly foolproof as far as the goals of getting a president who's been elected by the popular vote and isolating recounts and lawsuits. Now, look, you can argue about the theory of an electoral college and whether it ought to exist at all, but I happen to think it's appropriate given American federalism.
Now, here is somebody who thinks that there's going to be a class bias in the national service program. It's Kurt in Flanders. Hi, Kurt. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. I was thinking about the proposal, and what struck me is that a lot of the organizations that people will be able to go to outside of military service, as Professor Sabato stated, they won't be receiving even minimum wage. So that means who's going to pay for their housing and the cost of education? Therefore, I'm left to believe that only the children of people who are well-to-do, who can afford to subsidize their children into their early 20s, are going to be in a position to even be able to consider going to an organization like the ASPCA or Doctors Without Borders. These are highly educated people who would have to go into those lines of service. Who's going to pay for it? I think this is going to send a lot of people into military service because, number one, their families won't be able to support them, and number two, the positions are going to require such a high level of education that who can afford to come out of school with thousands and thousands of dollars of loans and bills and to work for next to nothing?
Yeah, thoughtful question. Professor?
Yeah, and I really want you to take a look at my chapter because I've addressed all of these questions. It's always tough to give you a sound bite.
Go to that class concern that he has.
Yeah, well, the class concern is resolved this way. Yes, there's a sub-minimum wage, but there are educational benefits for all, and I think, frankly, the educational benefits will be much more likely to accrue to the advantage of those who are lower class. Second, there's a housing allowance. Third, this is costed out in a way that's assigned partly to the groups, but also partly to the government. And that's the taxpayers. I understand that's taxpayer money, but you have to look at what the taxpayers are getting for it. For example, I propose a national disaster strike force for which you don't need a lot of initial training. You have some training in that task force. But think Katrina. Think about 100,000 young people moving in there in the way young people can. You know, they can sleep anywhere. They can subsist on little food for a while to help rebuild the region right after that disastrous hurricane instead of just depending on a relative handful of National Guards people and local law enforcement people.
And that is where we will leave it. Food for thought on Election Day 2007, a year before the presidential election of 2008, two of the 23 proposals to revitalize our Constitution, according to the book A More Perfect Constitution by University of Virginia political analyst Larry Sabato. Interesting stuff, very thought-provoking. Thank you for being so active in our democracy.
Thank you very much for having me, Ryan.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And for this election day, we'll continue in a minute with an informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific election day exit poll on the stem cell ballot question in New Jersey. Are you voting yes or are you voting no? Call us right now, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 on the stem cell question, or post to our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Also in a minute, we'll tell you some breaking news about a derailment in the subway. Stay with us.